The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, I'm Jerry Boyer. Welcome to Meeting of Minds podcast. Back for a repeat appearance is Peter Thiel. I think that's a name you're going to recognize, but just in case you don't, he is one of the most successful tech entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, is a founder of PayPal, arguably the most successful tech investor through the Founders Fund and other operations, and known, I think, most for his initial outside investment in Facebook. I think you're going to find, and if you listen to the previous interview, that he also has serious chops when it comes to philosophy and even theology. So first of all, Peter, thanks for joining us again.
Well, awesome. It's always fun to be here.
I went back and I re-listened to our last one, and there was so much popping there. I thought, oh, I forgot he said that. I forgot. By the way, I would say not a week goes by where I don't hear from some stranger on social media who says, when is there going to be another interview with Peter Thiel? So this, it really hit a nerve with people. I think people really want more of this discussion from you.
Well, let's go into it.
Okay. So last time you basically introduced people to the role that Rene Girard played in your life. And you kind of took us through how the Bible reads us. We think we're reading the Bible, but the Bible's really reading us. And you can step in and like take away the recap from me, but I'll just recap a little bit. And how the scapegoat mechanism is what the pagan world was built on. Christianity exposed the scapegoat mechanism, robbed it of its power. But now in postmodernism, we have a deformed kind of deformed outgrowth of Christianity, what you call the woke religion, which is always in search of victims to defend and always trying to scapegoat the scapegoaters. Does that sound like a pretty fair summary of our conversation before?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair summary. There's always some sense in which you could say that archaic culture or even sort of quasi satanic forms of government is the past that Christianity has abolished. But we're not living in the kingdom of heaven where all these forms don't exist anymore. And so there still are. Girard would say there still are all these kinds of scapegoating mechanisms that people are trying to figure out some ways to get these things to work again. Maybe you have to increase the dosage. So this would be like the totalitarian catastrophes of the 20th century where you couldn't just kill, a random witch in a village. You had to kill millions and millions of people. So it was sort of like this drug that doesn't work as well anymore. As people understand how it works, it paradoxically works less well. But that doesn't mean that people give up on it. They can increase the dosage. And then I think it can also go in these very strange hyper-Christian is the right word, but sort of modern, postmodern ways where we scapegoat the scapegoaters. We go after the people who were historical victimizers. So, in a communist context, it was the bourgeoisie, the aristocracy, the czar, the capitalists, and then in a woke 21st century American context, it is the descendants of the slave owners, the white people, the people who are can somehow be tied to this historical victimization, and then we victimize the victimizers, and somehow that still is always a pretty powerful move in our world. There's often a way to think of Nazism and communism as sort of enemy doubles. They're sort of mimetic twins, very, very similar to each other. Stalin, Hitler, they even had sort of both had sort of preposterous mustaches, and so all these sort of ways that they copied one another. And I think even the mass murder in some ways was mimetically copied from them. But one important difference is that Nazism was always it was always going back to the past. It was sort of pagan, and it was the historical victims really were guilty. The Jews, the handicapped people, the gays, these were genuinely the victims. Whereas communism was somehow a little bit more sophisticated, where it said that there were all these victims, and we have to go after we have to victimize the victimizers, and that was sort of like a slightly more sophisticated move. And I think Girard had sort of this intuition that even though they were, enemy doubles, in some ways very parallel, there's something about communism or wokeism that's the more powerful threat in our world, because it's sort of like it's a second order of victimization that still can work very powerfully.
And it has the power of the gospel. I mean, it's a distorted form. So the way you're describing this, in essence, fascism is a throwback to the pagan order. It's pre-Christian. We're just going to go back to, killing the outsider. We're going to, kill Oedipus. And communism is sort of post-Christian, but it has that, there's a power to the gospel story, and it taps into that power.
And this is probably always, it's not a terribly new phenomenon. There's always been, sort of a natural way for the gospel to be distorted in this way, where there's some sort of temptation for Christians to be more Christian than the other Christian, more Christian than Christ. That probably already in the first, second century AD, someone like Marcion, who tried to be progressive relative to St. Paul and say that the Old Testament God was too violent and he had too many victims, and so we have to radically differentiate the New Testament God from the Old Testament God, and we have to have this sort of more peaceful, loving God of the New Testament. And then, of course, it sort of was a way to had an anti-Semitic undercurrent to it, and all these things. But then you can think of from Marcion to Marx, a sort of a straight line. You have, of course, in Tolstoy, where the Christians will have we'll have peace in the kingdom of heaven. Here we will have peace on this earth. We'll do more than the Christians. In some ways, in an American context, I think there is some kind of pretty straight line from the social gospel of the early 20th century to the social justice of the early 21st century, and they're both very, very, very entangled with a certain progressive form of Christianity.
Yeah, I think the point you're making, well, you are making it, is essentially that what we see in this progressivism is not de novo, that there's almost like linear descent. You can see the transitional forms. It's not, some brand new, creature that in sort of Protestant mainlinism, you go from that to the social gospel, and then the gospelishness kind of gets dropped out pretty quickly, and pretty soon it's just, I'm thinking about Salman Rushdie being stabbed at Chautauqua. And Chautauqua is sort of, to me, that's the institution where it started by mainline Protestants. It's mainline, it's WASP ideology, then it's social gospel, and then it's simply progressivism. And of course, helpless against the violence, say, of Islamism, because Islam, Muslims are a victim group, and therefore, we have to surrender to them. So you're emphasizing a continuity that I haven't heard many other people emphasize, that wokeism wasn't just born yesterday. It was born in liberal mainline Protestantism.
There are all these ways that when I was an undergraduate at Stanford in the late 80s and then law school, I was there for 7 years from 1985 to 92. Started one of these conservative student newspapers. We got caught up in a lot of these, culture wars of the late 80s, early 90s. On campus, and I ended up writing with a friend of mine, David Sachs. We ended up writing this book, "The Diversity Myth: Multiculturalism and Politics of Intolerance on Campus." And it was sort of our attempt to do sort of a God and Man at Yale, focusing on Stanford. And for many years, I thought it was in some ways quite good. It was very comprehensive. We went through all sorts of craziness. It was an enormous amount of work we put into it. There was sort of, but for many years afterwards, I had some misgivings where I always felt, it's a little bit exaggerated. Is this really, these were just sort of campus hijinks, we're shooting fish in a barrel, showing these ridiculous people with their very illogical arguments. And then, of course, it has somehow had this, 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 uh, it has somehow returned in a redoubled way, starting in maybe 2014, 2015, in this sort of great awakening, where it's both been a campus phenomenon, but then also a broader American one. And I think the sort of critique, the two-part critique I would have of my book would be, of course, that one part of it is that somehow the arguments aren't quite on those terms. There's probably a structural part of it where, maybe the economic opportunities aren't that great, where these universities have become these sort of Malthusian places, where if you're in a grad school in chemistry and you have 10 people in the lab and only one of them will become a postgraduate student, and you have fistfights for beakers and Bunsen burners, and then if one person says something that's slightly politically incorrect, it's a relief to be able to throw that person off the very overcrowded bus. And so I think there's sort of a structuralist, pseudo Malthusian dynamic that that I think one can think that's created a sort of very zero sum, nature bared red in tooth and claw kind of diversity politics, and that on some level it operates sort of below the level of reason. And then I think there's probably that was the sort of college campus version, and then if we transpose this to the crazed blue cities of the last decade, the structuralist, the reductionist structuralist, Marxist or libertarian economic explanation is something that it has something to do with the runaway real estate costs, where you have this, you have this these sort of insane, insane housing costs. And maybe there's probably some way that this intensification of identity politics, wokeism, this whole set of things could also be just reductionistically explained in terms of real estate. So, for example, if you were sitting in 2007 in Manhattan or in San Francisco when the prices were already ridiculous, the quality was bad, everything was pretty awful in terms of the housing quality, can't build anything new. And you said, the prices are going to double. It'll be twice as expensive by 2022. Maybe a correct thing to predict would be you'd have to come up with some really, really crazy ideologies. There's like a gay version where, if you're a gay person in Manhattan, if you leave for Hoboken, New Jersey, you'll get beat up with a baseball bat right away. Or yes. if you're a woman and you don't like, living in your rat-infested apartment in San Francisco, if you were to move to Texas, well, you might just wake up pregnant one day and you'll be chained to your bed, and you can't you can leave your rat-infested apartment. And so,
and they won't let you get an abortion to deal with it, right? So they have to tell these horror stories about the realm outside the polis to keep people in the city of man.
And so there's sort of a structuralist explanation I have where this is maybe what had to happen when the real estate prices went from very high to absolutely insane, ridiculously high. It somehow caused the kind of the identity politics to go into this really crazed overdrive of one sort of or another. So I think there are these structural explanations that a lot of the conservative critics of these culture wars don't think about enough, and that are sort of one dimension, and certainly that I didn't think about enough when I wrote The Diversity Myth back in 1995. But that being said, the other dimension that I think is not thought of enough is this very deeply Christian, Judeo-Christian, religious dimension to it, where if it's a zero-sum Darwinian, Malthusian game that's going on, why does it take this specific form? We still have to say, why is it so focused on victims? Why is it so focused on these particular things? And I think that's where you have to think very hard about this religious question. And of course, there is, I would say there is a dimension to it where it's not completely wrong within a Christian context. We should have concern for the victims. There should be some kind of social gospel or social justice. It shouldn't be the main things, but it is somehow adjacent enough that it's a very big temptation. And then there are the ways that it can go wrong should be very understandable.
That's why it's a stronger move, right? Because there is an ethical element here. We really should care about victims, and it gets its power from that.
For example, the what you could say the sort of non-Christian conservative, the sort of Nietzschean, Ayn Randian, I'm not sure, neo-pagan, that sort of seems non-existent, but sort of the non-religious conservative move is always to say these people are exaggerating, you know, these victims weren't quite real, the suffering wasn't that bad. And I do think that's always a losing move. We should never question that the victims, for the most part, were very real. It's just what we should question is whether, you know, there's certain ways where we're just creating this perpetual motion machine and creating new classes of victims today.
So the strong counter move to the strong move of woke religion is not, no, they're not really victims. No, there isn't any racism. No, women have never been abused. No, gay people have never been mistreated. The denial, which is sort of moving backwards in time, is the weak counter move.
You will always lose. You will always lose that sort of argument. You know, I mean, yes, there's, you know, there's the 1619 project where, you know, which when slavery started in the U.S. and then somehow there's a story where, I don't want to say that the U.S. was fundamentally flawed or that it was, you know, that something was irredeemably flawed about that. But it is probably not wrong as a Christian to speak of the original sin of slavery in the founding of this country. And you know, if you look at the second inaugural speech by Abraham Lincoln, you know, it's in 1865, time of his second inaugural, and then he, you know, I'm going to sort of paraphrase it, but, you know, he references back to, you know, well, you know, we've had this very bloody civil war, and, you know, it's gone on much longer than people would have thought, but we're not going to question God because we obviously had this very great sin of slavery. And if the war should go on for, you know, 250 years, we because we had slavery for 250 years, we still couldn't question God's judgment on that. And of course, 250 years before 1865 gets you to roughly 1619. So it's sort of like Lincoln is kind of referencing 1619 in his second inaugural. And then if we had 250 years forward of, you know, bloody racial conflict to atone for slavery, Lincoln was saying, yeah, if we're still fighting in 2115, 93 years from now, we couldn't say that this was some problem of theodicy that showed that God was not really good.
So I guess the difference between Lincoln's second inaugural and the 1619 project is that Lincoln calls for charity towards all and malice towards none. In other words, it includes the Christian forgiveness message. Yes, they were enemies, they're brothers and they were enemies, but now there's forgiveness. Now we need to forgive one another. Whereas the 1619 project and CRT, it has a doctrine of the fall, it has a doctrine of original sin. It just doesn't have a doctrine of forgiveness. It has no redemption.
Yes, no, I think there's probably something about the question of forgiveness specifically that is really central to this. And I think to even talk of forgiveness in our hyper politicized context, people often think, well, that's again just a way to avoid responsibility, the way not to talk about them. But yes, I agree with you. There has to be some way to talk about the madness and murder that was the past, and to also find a way to forgive and to move on. And Christianity says you have to somehow do both. You know, we can't keep the veil. Keep some veil of ignorance over the past that's been abolished by the revelation, and we also can't. But then also, if we don't find a way to forgive, nothing will possibly work.
Hi everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolfe. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
I wonder if the accusational style of the current hyper-Christian, ultra-Christian phrases that you and Gerard have used, which I like very much, if the accusational power of that has made it almost impossible for the rest of us to talk in a rational way. What I find is in conservative circles now, you can't acknowledge the sin of slavery. You know, in the moment you're doing that, you're woke now. If you say anything about discrimination, about racism, et cetera, oh, you're woke. You're just joining the crowd that's accusing us. And I don't think we've found a way to talk about it the way you're talking about, which is to say, yeah, slavery was the original sin of America. There was a bloody civil war. That was just given the horrors of slavery. Now, how do we move forward from that? Forgiveness, repentance, whatever. The moment we participate in a dialogue, I find other conservatives are reacting to that like, oh no, you're giving in.
Yes, well, but again, this is also where, maybe a Girardian or more broadly Christian intuition is that you can't whitewash this. You know, it's Abel's blood still cries from the ground. You know, it's not just at that time. I think it's present tense in Genesis. It's still crying from the ground today, and in some sense, all the blood that's been shed since the foundation of the world, it doesn't seem to be going away. There are all these things where it would be nice if we could talk about it less, but I think that's. That's not an option. That's not an option at all.
Interesting. Right. The blood of your brother cries from the ground. And it's interesting in that passage, Ach is brother. Six times. Strong. It's a strong number. God says brother, brother, brother to Cain. So that's suggesting that brotherhood is part of the solution, that the contrast here is he's supposed to be your brother, but you turned him into an animal. You slaughtered him. He goes, because Cain says, well, I'm not supposed to be my brother's keeper. See, that's animal language. Abel was a shepherd. Am I the shepherd's shepherd? Well, no, but you are his brother and you shouldn't kill him. So I wonder to what degree our whole national conversation is really taking place in the realm of politics. And in politics, forgiveness, that's kind of a weak move, an apology, and we can't get past it politically. But if we move over to the realm of religion, and I mean revealed religion, I don't mean archaic religion. Really, if we center in on the person of Christ and on the brother-brother relationship that Christians have with one another, maybe that is the only way forward, that is the only strong counter move, that it can't be done in the political mimetic rivalry. They're so entangled that we really can't have this conversation in politics. We can only have it in a religious theological discussion. What do you think about that?
I think if it's in a narrow political context, it's always going to get weaponized and misinterpreted, one way or another. I don't know, just to go down another version, there's always sort of a question where did it become too hard for Christians to insist on forgiveness? And sort of one sort of rough candidate where I think is something like the Nazi Holocaust of the Jews, where I think in the 1960s, 1970s, you still had conversations about the Holocaust in which Christians and Jewish people would talk about it, and the Christian theologians would say, well, you should actually find some way to forgive and move on, And I think that's actually become very, very hard to say, even in a religious context. It feels like you're recapitulating the anti-Semitism because you're telling the Jews they're supposed to become Christians. Some forgiveness in the Old Testament, but you're supposed to somehow lean into the sort of New Testament message of forgiveness. So it's somehow doubly offensive. But then if we say that there are certain crimes that are so great that they can't be forgiven, does that end up becoming an opening for more and more things like that. And so I think I wonder if there's some kind of Jewish Christian dialogue that's very, very important to this, and that when if we use the word, you know, the word Judeo-Christian is this catch-all word that maybe also obscures things, and there are things we need to learn from the Jews, and there are things Christians can teach the Jews. There's some sort of healthier dialogue that would happen if you didn't just have this this blanket phrase Judeo-Christian.
Hmm. So the Holocaust might be the event in the 20th century in which, at least in the beginning, forgiveness becomes, it's in some way almost a forbidden conversation in certain contexts.
Even among Christian theologians, even in a religious Christian context, mm-hmm. I don't think this is scapegoating Hitler, but maybe Hitler was even worse than we thought. That if you say that, you know, one of the legacies of Hitler was to commit a crime so terrible that we don't think it can be forgiven, and then is that a way in which, you know, Hitler did more damage to Christianity than almost anything else he did?
Yeah. So I suppose what I'm hearing you say, reading between the lines, is that if you talk about forgiveness of the great atrocities of our time, that is recast as a re-victimization. If you say we need to have forgiveness for the past history of racism, well, anyone calling for forgiveness is essentially re-victimizing. That if you forgive, you are not forgiving a sin. You are denying, really, that it ever really was a sin. They have trouble making the distinction between acknowledging an evil, which I think Lincoln did very well in the second inaugural, and acknowledging an evil and then saying, yes, but more evil won't solve that, as opposed to, as you say, whitewashing an evil.
Yeah, no, look, there obviously are a lot of very fine lines. You know, it's somehow, yeah, someone we need to forgive. It doesn't mean that we don't talk about this, that we don't, you know, so whitewashing is you somehow obscure the history. You don't talk about the history. But yeah, there has to be some way to talk about it, and then also to forgive.
Hmm. So instead of, I said maybe this has to take place in a religious context, and you're saying it hasn't always worked so well, and I take your point.
I'm agreeing with you, but there are versions of it where I think even the religious context have been tricky.
So I wonder to what degree it has to be very focused on the historical person of Christ, who suffered horrible, horrible things. And while they were going on, said, forgive them, Father, because they don't know what they do. I mean, was Jesus wrong? Was he whitewashing what was being done to him? Was he whitewashing what Romans had done to Jews in the past? Was he whitewashing what the Sanhedrin had done to righteous Jews? No, it's fully acknowledging the evil of it and yet forgiving in the midst of it. And it's pretty hard once you're centered on the person of Christ to say, oh, no, forgiveness would be a mistake. That's empowering the injustice. The most unjustly treated man in history forgave.
Yes, there's some sense in which, you know, they did not fully know what they were doing, because it was sort of a mob phenomenon. It was some kind of, you know, I don't mean to say the mob was demonically possessed. There was some sense in which, you know, they weren't really anywhere close to their senses, and that's, you know, and so if humans were these omniscient beings who could understand things in this perfectly rational way, then maybe forgiveness would be harder, because people actually knew exactly what they were doing, and there was obviously a very large, and this is, you know, this is always the, you know, a certain version where, you know, demons can't be forgiven because they somehow have perfect rational foreknowledge. And then there's a way that humans simply don't, and then we're caught up in crazy mimetic dynamics. You know,
the demons know, right? James says they believe in God, but they shudder. But humans are ignorance.
I do think there's something about the ignorance that's it doesn't absolve you entirely, but it's one of the reasons you can be forgiven. And then of course there are just all these dynamics people get caught up in, where I think there's always one of the mistakes I think it always would is to make is to say that, you know, if we would have lived in the time of Christ, we would have been differently. And that's because we would have known better. And no, you would have still gotten caught up like, you know, Peter, you know, his threefold denial, or, you know, all, you know, the disciples just sort of all ran away. And and you know, the Christian story is very, very different from, let's say, the Platonic Socrates story, where, you know, the myth that Plato wants to tell about Socrates is that philosophy preserved truth, and that Plato or Xenophon stayed true. They were against the city, they resisted the mob. And the New Testament account, in some sense, deconstructs the Platonic Socrates account. The New Testament tells us what Plato really was doing at the time of when Socrates was being accused. He was running away. He was hiding under his bed. He was saying he had nothing to do with that man, or something like this. And then it was just the later mythical reconstruction, where there was this, you know, robust system of philosophy that could always resist the mob, and that was pure in its rationality and its thought and in its rigor. And Christianity says that that's not true. Even Peter, the rock on whom the church was going to be built, was not solid enough. And if Peter wasn't solid enough, then certainly we should assume Plato wasn't either.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So the idea of the Gospels is the deconstruction.
Well, they read us. They read us.
They tell the truth about us.
You read Peter's motives, but you're also reading Plato.
Hmm. And in the late 1800s, early 1900s, as the American and British ruling elites are turning away from Christianity, they're turning towards Greek philosophy. I think in some sense, the illusion that philosophy and aesthetics are strong while revelation is weak was kind of the basis of our civilization's apostasy. We're just going to be like Socrates and just follow the truth. We're going to follow philosophy, not religion, not revelation. And of course, it's blind, right? And it's based on lies.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's a great deal that one can say sort of about the, you know, biblical or Judeo-Christian thread in the history of the West versus the sort of Greco-Roman classical piece. But with Girard, I prefer the more disjunctive accounts, where we think of you know, and I'm somewhat skeptical of, you know, the various ways people try to meld them into a single system, whether it was, you know, Augustine or Thomistic philosophy, where you sort of find some synthesis between Aristotle and medieval Catholic thought, and I think that, you know, maybe in our context the healthier thing is to stress the differences, and that on the side of the Bible there is a knowledge that you do not have. There's a knowledge about anthropology, psychology, human nature that the classics did not have, and then there is also sort of it is a world in which you're supposed to forgive, you're supposed to have mercy. It's a very different picture of how one should act ethically.
So I wonder if, to some degree, we as, let's say, just conservative Christians, very broad term, right? Some Orthodox people who are not part essentially of the left coalition. If we have trouble making the strong counter moves because we're too entangled with pagan modes of thought and pagan metaphysics, so that we're too tied to paganism and unwilling to emphasize the sharp discontinuity. You mentioned Marshall.
Yeah, there are versions of this that I'm certainly guilty of to varying degrees. You know, I find myself getting entangled in politics all the time. And it's, you know, and I tell myself it's very important. It's like the air we breathe, and then it's also very toxic. I think there is something about it that's, you know, not precisely divinely ordained, to put it very charitably, that, you know, the principalities and powers of this world, you know, there are ways they can be, you know, they can somehow be accommodative to the church. And there are all these ways where, you know, where they're quite at odds with it, and you know, we still need some kind of the old sacred structures, of the old violent structures, to make things work, even though, and we shouldn't get rid of them altogether. that will lead to pandemonium. But
you mean like we can't abolish? You're saying we can't abolish the state, for example. Is that what you're?
I would say maybe one way to say it is the state contains violence in both senses of the word contain. The nation state contains violence. It is part of its very being. It's part of its essence is to be violent. But then it also limits violence. It is Satan expelling Satan. It's violence limiting violence. And then, you know, that you get all sorts of, you know, kinds of debates where, you know, it's like, you know, God created man and John Colt made him equal. It's sort of my pro-gun argument. You know, if we're going to have violence, maybe the guns can be used to even it out and make people behave better. And then, of course, there are all these ways where people behave worse. But yeah, it's very, very entangled. I often, again, sort of the retro-Christian thing that I sometimes like saying more just to provoke people is that I sometimes wonder if I like the Christianity of Constantine more than the Christianity of Mother Teresa, where Constantine was, you know, obviously a very far from perfect person. He far from perfect Christian. He was perhaps honest enough not to convert to Christianity until he was on his deathbed, because as long as he was emperor, he had to do all these very non-Christian things to kind of hold things together. And there's something about that tries to deal with the violence of the state, and the reality of an individual Christian life and how those things can be reconciled. It was the debate in the Middle Ages. Could a king ever really go straight to heaven, or was anyone who was a king, did they have to spend a lot of time in purgatory because they'd done a lot of really bad things?
So Constantine, as an emperor, as a Roman emperor, couldn't fully be a Christian. I mean, what would he have done? Disbanded the armies and said, we're done now, and then the barbarians come? When we live in this world that's half pagan.
Or, yeah, again, it would have presumably looked so weak that, yeah, whatever order he was able to recreate would have, it was a great deal of violence was needed to try to sort of hold things together in a way for another, you know, century and a half or whatever Constantine bought.
So the word that's coming to mind right now is catacomb, right?
Yes.
That there's a restrainer, right? This is from Second Thessalonians and something that Gerard talks about a lot. So in some sense, the old pagan world is a restrainer of evil, even though, and it's a source of evil at the same time.
Yes.
And when that breaks apart, the man of sin, the man of lawlessness.
Yes.
Comes, right. And so how do we be Christians in the world without the catacomb, without the restrainer of paganism, of blood and violence, without unleashing the man of lawlessness, and so there's nothing but violence in the land. I mean, I think that's what you're talking about. Am I reading you correctly?
Yeah, I think this. I guess I would say, and it was just maybe too abstract, but I would say that. I think one should always we shouldn't try to get rid of all forms of the catacomb, all forms of law and order, you know, all forms of archaic structure and violence, because we also can't rely on them indefinitely, because they all have, you know, Christianity is, it is historical. It is in some sense even progressive. Yes. And these structures, they have some life appointed to them. And at some point they will cease to work. And you know, it's possible that something that ends up being a catacomb ends up being more, you know, more accelerationist. So, you know, if there were German conservatives who thought that Hitler in the 1930s was catacombic because you were reinforcing the nation state, and then that nationalism was somehow would slow down the one world state of the Antichrist, and then in these terms. It was quite the opposite, that Hitler was such a crazy, destructive person that you accelerated it and you created the United Nations, which started as the Nations United Against Fascism. And so, mm-hmm. so something, it was not catacombic at all. It was just, it was just completely accelerationist. So sort of as a question, there's a question whether every catechon has a place, but then ultimately becomes a false catechon, becomes accelerationist. I know that you're sort of a little bit more on, you know, you tend to think all the sort of antichrist apocalyptic things should be situated more in the sort of preterist first century, second century AD thing. And I'm still somehow more in the medieval camp where we have to place them a little bit in the future. But one literary, I'll do it as a literary thing. You can interpret it prophetically or literarily, but one literary idea I've been toying with is sort of this, it's always the connection between the Antichrist and Armageddon. And they sort of, you know, it's, you have the Antichrist, the man of lawlessness, slogan is peace and safety, Thessalonians 5:3, and then you end up with Armageddon, and somehow the one world state doesn't really stop Armageddon. But the literary thought I've had is that, you know, maybe the Antichrist, the way he comes to power, the way you get the sort of one world state in which people give up on their sovereignty and give up on their freedom and their autonomy, is that he tells a very compelling story that we're on a countdown to Armageddon, and that the risks are very great and very dangerous, and that this is necessary, and so that the Antichrist will actually present himself as a catechontic figure, mm-hmm. who is preserving order, preserving peace and safety. And if you talk too much about Armageddon, you're secretly pushing the agenda of the Antichrist.
Yeah, I think that's great. That's fascinating.
In a very sort of applied tech version, where, you know, there sort of are obviously all these forms of science and technology that are very powerful, seemingly quite dangerous in the world post 1945. You know, René Girard focused on nuclear, thermonuclear weapons, but, you know, we also have variations of AI technology where it could be the super duper artificial general intelligence, which is somehow smarter and more powerful than any human being, but it can also be the dumb AI that is sort of, you know, the centralized surveillance state. It can be the dumb AI a la TikTok that just deranges the discourse. So it can be a dumb centralized versus a dumb decentralized AI. It can be the obviously like bioweapons things. There are you know, killer robots. There are all kinds of sort of fairly dangerous modalities of technology. You know, maybe on the left there's certain kinds of environmental catastrophes, climate change, things like this. And then I think I think one of the sort of ideas that I see gaining a lot more traction in the last few decades is something you could call sort of the precautionary principle, that we should be, we should be extremely careful. People don't quite come out and say that we should be Luddite, but there should be a lot of restrictions on developing these new technologies. We need to be, you know, we don't want to, you know, with climate change, we should just, you know, reduce the carbon dioxide emissions. We shouldn't build newfangled fusion reactors or do geoengineering. So there are all these, you know, solutions that where you lean into tech, but the general precautionary principle intuition is that you lean away from it. You should do a little bit less. We need to dial back the nuclear thing, you know, and then the AI research, the Silicon Valley version of this is just, it's so dangerous. We should just slow this down and stop it as quickly as possible. And that's sort of a big Silicon Valley undercurrent. And then I was reading this academic paper by Bostrom from 3-4 years ago, just pre-COVID. But the basic argument was, if we take the dangers of these technologies very seriously, you know, we need to have, you know, global governance. We need to make sure that people with sort of crazy different views are really restricted on being able to push them and to explore these things, because that's very, very dangerous. And because we're living in this fragile world where all this stuff can go wrong. And then, you know, in the footnotes, it's like, yeah, some people will be uncomfortable because it sounds sort of totalitarian and things like this. But, you know, it's obviously worth the risk. And so I think, uh, I think something as non-theological sounding as the precautionary principle, I would place it as a kind of catechon for the 21st century. But then we have to also ask whether it is the sort of false catechon that will be used in an accelerationist way by someone like the Antichrist.
So the warning of apocalypse is used to create power accumulations and institutions, which are actually the bringers of the apocalypse.
They certainly in the biblical account they don't stop it, I think it is right to be afraid of Armageddon. It's right to be, you know, have somewhat of a fear of nuclear war, there is the other side of that where we don't want to use that as a justification for a society where we're in complete lockdown, where everyone's in a padded room, nobody can do anything, and where you can't develop any more science technology, you can't think, you can't explore ideas, and then in some sense, of course, I think that the lockdowns that we had for 2 years in COVID are just an instance of the kind of lockdown we've had on science and technology for close to half a century, and that something like this has been the not entirely irrational, pretty well grounded fear that has underlied it. But the problem when you only think about Armageddon is that you forget about the totalitarian one world state.
So the challenge is, there are a lot of challenges, but the challenge that I'm hearing you describe is that there are these institutions which are mainly pagan. They restrain evil, but they participate in evil, paganism, archaic religion, etc. And that they kind of have their place to play, they have their role to play. But there's a final one who says, oh, I'll keep the evil away, but is the evil, right? So a lot of people signed on to Hitler because someone's got to fight the commies, right? And Mussolini was fighting the commies, and General Francisco Franco was fighting the commies. So there were some, people that, in retrospect, obviously anyone who signed on to that coalition looks completely morally, compromised. But what fear led them to think of fascism as plausible? It was the fear of communism.
Yes.
But as you point out, bad move. Because the people you turned to out of fear of communism brought the bad things that you were trying to avoid.
Yeah, it's very weird. It was somehow mimetically entangled. I think the fascists in the 1930s weren't as bad as the communists. They started copying them, but it was somehow they got all the mass violence ideas probably from the communists in some ways. But yeah, it somehow was a very bad move. I still like to think that. The 1980s Reagan move was a somewhat healthy version of this, where it was this odd coalition of somewhat incoherent coalition of free market economists and social conservatives and defense hawks. And you always ask the question, what does the millionaire and the priest and the general, what do those three people have in common? The millionaire, the priest, and the general, the three parts of the Reagan coalition, they're anti-communist.
Opposition. Yeah, anti-communist, exactly, right.
Maybe that's a weird negative glue to bind, but my judgment was that was still
and you see that
more Reagan, healthy than it's, yeah, than not pulling that off.
Of course. But you see that in Reagan's foreign policy, especially the support for a Somoza or the support for a Marcos. It's like, yeah, they're bad. Gene Kirkpatrick's
the authoritarian versus totalitarian.
Precisely. Totalitarians are worse. On the other hand, there is a point at which our restrainers are so compromised, so non-Christian, that for Christians to align with them, like which we agree, we shouldn't have hid behind the fascists. We understand why Christians did, but bad move. There is a time when we have to watch who we align with. Because that might be a false catechon, a false restrainer of evil, a bringer of what we fear.
Sure, sure. And there may be ways these things are very time limited. That the longer you are entangled with these things, the more these things become mimetically emulative. Where I don't know. There's some version of this where the U.S. was very entangled with the Soviet Union after World War II, and there were sort of all these ways our society became more socialist. We needed unemployment insurance. We needed, Medicare, and we needed to provide a lot of the same things people had in the Soviet Union because we're in this sort of mimetic competitive game, and there probably was something very important about Reagan trying to bring about some kind of end game, because if this sort of mimetic entanglement had gone on for, another 40 or 50 years, we might have copied a lot more of the bad elements from the Soviet Union than we did. And of course, there's probably some conservative perspective one could have where we actually copied more than we did. And, D.C. is sort of like this bureaucracy like Russia in a way that it was not, say.
So convergence theory wasn't necessarily wrong, but human agency of one man, Ronald Reagan, essentially made convergence theory wrong by provoking the conflict early enough that it was either we were going to win or they were going to win.
There were still real differences. And so So when we won in 89, yet we were not yet, a fully communist country. If it had gone on for another 50 or 100 years, the sort of the Orwell 1984, Oceania versus Eurasia, they're all the same.
Yes. All right. So where we left off in our last interview was, is there a Girardian, and maybe I stop saying Girardian, Christian. To the degree that Girard has, I think, explicated for us a dimension to Jesus's teaching that was not clear to the church before. Is there an off-ramp from this? Now, I asked it as though there has to be an off-ramp, but you might be saying, well, no, we've got to deal with Constantine, but we also have our religious life, and that's just where it is for now. We don't need an off-ramp, but we maybe control the amount to which we get mimetically entangled with the mimetic rivalry of the world. So and Girard seemed to want to take the off-ramp when he talked about political atheism. So I don't know what the question is. I'm throwing something out there just to get you to react.
Girard was also himself all over the map on this. So, he was a political atheist, but then he also thought de Gaulle was just the right thing for France in the 50s and 60s. And, he's probably somewhat pro-Reagan. Later was a little bit more anti-Bush 43. So there were all these sort of judgments that he had on the various people. But yeah, in theory, he was a political atheist in that, he did not think the state was divinely ordained and that, there was no daylight between, let's say, the government and God or something like that. I think, it's always hard to know how one translates it practically. Probably one of the things that I always find very tempting to do on a personal level with the mimetic part of the Girard theory is, there are all these bad forms of mimesis, and if you're more aware of them, maybe you don't get caught up in them as much. As an investor, you have all these mimetic bubbles in markets and don't want to get too caught up in it. And so there's always sort of this thought I have in the background that surely there's some way in which if you're very aware of it, that can help. And I think it has a certain limited truth, but it's striking how Girard's intuition was actually quite different, which was that I have this theory of psychology, of mimetic psychology, but a therapist isn't going to help you. If you want to solve it, you have to actually just go to church, and that was that was just the advice. You just have to go to church, because somehow, the therapist will you'll go through and you'll realize all these crazed mimetic things you're in, but then at the end of years of therapy, does it help you transcend it, or does it just rationalize it?
Yeah, and map it right and detail it out. Then there's
it's sort of there's always the thing I think is I don't think psychology's completely a failed field, but the the very odd thing about psychology is that it gets advertised as self-transformation, and then it and then after years of therapy, you're sort of exhausted paying the bills, you get bored with the therapist, and it often cashes out as self-acceptance, and one day you just wake up and suddenly realize everything's fine with me. And yeah. And that's it is there's something odd about something that's marketed as self-transformation and crashes into self-acceptance. There probably are versions of psychology.
That's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
That can work better or differently, but I think Girard would have said that somehow real transformation was religious. It was something like a conversion experience. And that something like the great authors had something close to a conversion experience where they somehow saw that their former selves had been completely wrong about the world, and it was as powerful as a conversion experience, and anything less than that would not do.
Well, this is interesting because mimetic theory allows you to see a lot of your motivations, and then you think, okay, then I'll have a superpower, and I won't be mimetically entangled. But you still are. You just understand why you are, to some degree. But going to church and reading the Gospels and imitating Christ is, in some ways, Girardian theory is still philosophy, right? It's a better philosophy. But in the end, reading all the Girard books aren't going to do it. Imitating Christ.
Maybe one way to summarize it, it's always sort of a question about, maybe it's a question about how changeable we are as humans. How much can we change about ourselves or who we are? And I think I think you can think of the mimetic theory as it was somewhere in between these two extremes in psychology, or maybe broader modernity, where one version is something that there's sort of a deep nature, and there are these natural categories of things, and you can't change your nature at all, and things are just completely set by your genes, by your environment, or it's some kind of platonic essence or something like that. That's sort of one extreme. And then, I think the other extreme is a sort of romanticist, existentialist, you're free to be whoever you want to be. You can wake up and change everything about you. It's all sort of in your power. And we have these two very different diametrically opposed things, and somehow the mimetic theory was supposed to take this somewhat in between ground, which is you can't imitate, you can't not imitate, you can't choose not to imitate, you can't choose not to be mimetic. Maybe with great difficulty you can change your role model and do something like this, but that seems to me also to be what the rough flavor of a Christian account of the self or of psychology or the individual would be, is that it's not completely unchangeable, and it's not easily changeable.
It reminds me a lot of Augustine, right? Non posse picari, non posse non picari, posse picari, right? So we are
Saul on the road to Damascus, or it's yes, there is a conversion to Christianity is an enormous change. It is one that you're capable of. It's in some sense very hard. In some sense, it should it's all whether it's God's grace, some human freedom, exactly how that works. It's somehow the most important change you can make. That somehow is a very hard but very possible change for each of us, and that somehow has to be roughly the account we have of psychology generally. That it's neither these Platonic essences, where nothing can ever change, you're a natural slave, you're natural whatever, right. And it can't be some sort of Sartre existentialism where one day you wake up and you can just choose to jump out the window because that's what you're feeling like.
Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. You're talking about the hard work of personal sanctification. If there's hope of an off ramp from Armageddon, it's in that hard place, not in the mimetic entanglement of whatever is the great scrum in the world.
If we say we have nothing but our death instincts to guide us, that's not very promising. And if we say, if we say that, it's just all you have to do is go to Burning Man and have, you know, a magical evening, that probably won't quite cut it either. So it's somewhere in between.
Wonderful. We've reached the end of our allotted time, but I want to make sure if there's anything that you wanted to say that you didn't get a chance to say, that you have an opportunity. I've enjoyed this a great deal. I'm not sure that people understand what kind of spiritual depth. I mean, you're known as a kind of political commentator to some degree, and obviously as a tech entrepreneur, but I'm not sure that people are aware that, you know, kind of this Girardian theological, you know, this thought process that you're going through. And I'm glad you were willing to share it with people.
I've been very struck by this idea of that every catechon risks becoming a false catechon, and the Antichrist as presenting himself as catechontic.
I really love that. Yeah, you're suggesting that for a next topic of conversation?
Or we can start with that or develop it some more.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it works with preterism and futurism because it could be it happened in the first century, but it keeps happening because the patterns repeat themselves.
Something like that.
Let's dig into that more. Thank you so much for being with us.
All right, be well.
You too.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.